You are listening to the Freight Buyers Club, a home for those interested in international trade, shipping, procurement, logistics, and air freight. In fact, all things supply chain in the Americas, Asia, and beyond. This podcast is brought to you by your host, Mike King, and produced in partnership with Demerco Express Group, a global 3PL that specializes in managing logistics to, from, and within the Asia-Pacific region.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Freight Buyers Club, which, as you've just heard, is produced with the support of Demerco Express Group. I'm Mike King, and please do follow this podcast on your platform of choice, including YouTube, where you'll also find loads of additional shorter video interviews and news insights. You can also subscribe and listen at www.thefreightbuyersclub.com. Today, we're going to look at a whole bunch of economic and supply chain indicators and freight markets of interest to US shippers, as well as considering what's going to happen later this year and indeed beyond. Helping me understand and process this supply chain fog are two people who come at this from decidedly different angles. First up, it's a global supply chain thought leader and an academic and analyst of huge renown. Jason Miller, Eli Brode Professor in Supply Chain Management at Michigan State University. Welcome back to the Freight Buyers Club. How are you doing?
Doing well. Thank you for having me back, Mike.
And joining Jason today to give us a look at the world of freight markets from a retailer's perspective is Jessica Dankert, Vice President for Supply Chain Retail at Retail Industry Leaders Association. Welcome back, Jess.
Good to be here.
I think we have to start with the latest news on US tariffs ahead of the presidential election in November. We've seen that President Biden has ramped up tariff rates on a bunch of Chinese imports recently, continuing this trade war with China that started under President Trump and has bilateral support, it would seem, politically. Donald Trump has threatened much higher imports on Chinese goods, sort of pushing over 60%. We've also had mention of a universal tariff of 10%. On top of that, in the last week, Trump's last national security advisor, Robert O'Brien, who it seems remains in very close contact with the former president, said, and I quote, "As China seeks to undermine American economic and military strength, Washington should return the favor." Furthermore, he argues, and I again quote, "The 60% tariffs on China that Trump has floated should be only the first step, followed by tougher export controls on any technology that might be of use to China and other measures." Didn't define other measures. Sounds quite sinister. It seems he's calling for a total economic decoupling of the US and China, which, given how interwoven both economies still are, and given that we are talking about the two largest economies in the world, I guess this question is to both of you. If this happens, what impact does this have in the US and beyond?
So I can start with that, and I'm going to read actually from an abstract from a working paper by some of the top economists in the world, led by David Autor. The paper is called "The Employment and Electoral Effects of the Trump Tariffs in the United States." So this is looking at 2018 and 2019, and this is from the abstract. Quote, "The trade war has not to date provided economic help to the U.S. heartland. Import tariffs on foreign goods neither raised nor lowered U.S. employment in newly protected sectors. Retaliatory tariffs had clear negative employment impacts, primarily in agriculture." So if we now take that and extrapolate from it, there will be no economic benefit that the U.S. has from, let's say, a manufacturing employment standpoint, which has been the primary rationale advanced for increasing tariffs. The retaliatory tariffs will be very negatively impactful, though, because the U.S. is very much export-oriented in certain industries. And this data is not a closely guarded secret. You can get it from UN Comtrade, or you can get it from the US Census Bureau. And so what you'll see is retaliatory tariffs from anyone whom we tariff, which if we're talking the world, will be everyone, that will target certain US sectors that are very export sensitive. Farmers will be the most impacted. And so I see no economic upside to this. It will be a tax on consumers. And frankly, I think it's one of the dumbest economic policies I've ever heard of.
Obviously, I'm in the UK here, and a lot of farmers voted for Brexit, even though they were cutting themselves off from their biggest market. Why would farmers would be sort of slightly crazy if they were supportive of these tariffs or those that propose them?
I think part of it is it's just the raw politics right now and emotion of this. You know, in the United States, we've had, you know, manufacturing employment is down over 4 million from where it was in the 1990s. And certainly part of this was due to the China shock of the U.S. starting to import more from China. So many of those jobs were in, let's say, apparel manufacturing, which was an industry that was not destined to be, you know, the long-term manufacturing mecca of the United States. But I think that there's just a lot of raw politics involved. And I think a lot of people are voting on other issues in the U.S. that may not be directly related to sort of these broad economic discussions.
Jess, what's the view from retailers?
Well, I think Jason really hit on it. Tariffs are taxes on American businesses, consumers, and workers. And it's important to note, you know, this is election rhetoric as well. And then, you know, what actually happens, regardless of who wins the White House. Retailers basically want to see the U.S. government focus on smart trade policy that opens up new markets and reduces tariff and non-tariff barriers, addresses unfair trade practices without this unnecessary collateral damage to American businesses and consumers.
I'm going to test your imaginations here. So in this decoupled world that O'Brien would like to see, what does things like China Plus One, what does that look like? And is it even possible that you can engineer or restructure the U.S. economy in this decoupled way?
We're not decoupling with China short of a war. I mean, short of a shooting war, that's not going to happen. There's just no way at this point. The two economies are so intertwined. And we also have to have the idea, what does decoupling mean? So if we're not buying directly from China, but it's instead being produced by a Chinese company in Mexico or a Chinese company in Vietnam, that's not decoupling. And so in a world of, as we call them in economics, transnational manufacturers, these ideas of like that we're going to somehow decouple these two economies, this just doesn't exist. This is not the Cold War in the 1960s, 1970s. And so unfortunately, we have policy that seems to think like that. And I'm going to pick a little bit and say that's because a lot of these folks date from that era. And maybe we need to have more contemporary thought that is considering the globalized nature of the U.S. economy.
What's the contemporary thoughts of retailers on this, Jess?
As Jason said, I think, you know, the idea of 100% decoupled economy is simply not realistic. At this day and age where the economy is so globalized, so transnational, large retailers are continually evaluating their sourcing profile and making adjustments for lots of reasons, whether that's diversification, you know, sourcing, supply chain considerations, resiliency. All of these are kind of critical components to that sourcing strategy. I think it is interesting, you know, as Jason mentioned, we're seeing actually this growth of this nearshoring in Mexico, Central America, South America, and a lot of that may be from Asian-owned corporations. So this idea that it's as clear cut and black and white as a decoupling that you can simply, you know, shut the door on is not the kind of nuanced world that we live in. So it's interesting to watch kind of that nearshoring and the leveling up of investment in that kind of nearshoring space. But I think, you know, I don't want to say we're at an inflection point on it, but definitely a lot of progress there. And I think that adds to the complexity of the conversation around imports from Asia and China specifically.
Fancy there being no black and white solutions in our own amazingly complex world. Okay, a bit later, we'll look at the specifics of some of the supply chain disruptions that might be coming down the pipeline apart from tariffs. But let's have a little reflection or have a look at how things have been going so far this year. Jess, would it be fair to say that most of your members thought they'd seen the last of soaring freight rates, battling for space, coping with multiple supply chain events and all the rest of it? Would it be fair to say that 2024 has caught them by surprise?
The last few years have been such a wild ride for retail supply chains. I'm not sure there's much left that would really surprise the folks in retail supply chain at this point. I mean, when the Red Sea situation flared up in December, I think we kind of all knew it wasn't going to be the quiet, relaxing supply chain year that some might have been hoping for in 2024. It's challenging to be in a situation right now that we're seeing with those soaring freight rates, turning carriers' heads and making it tough for contract shippers to get access to space. But, with everything that continues to go on, whether it's the Red Sea, whether it's congestion in Asian ports of origin, the Panama Canal, I think we'll probably talk a little bit more later about the East Coast labor negotiations in the U.S. It's really always something. So I think at this point, with a bit of a gimlet eye, our retail supply chain folks have just adjusted to a state of ongoing disruption and something new to greet them each morning.
Oh, I'll just throw in there, Panama Canal water levels are increasing. Some positives out there.
Some positives, yes. Yeah. We're hoping for more rain.
Jason, how do you view all this international chaos? It sort of started with vessels being diverted away from Houthi rockets around southern Africa, and also, I guess, taking in the water levels on the Panama Canal earlier this year. We've had the Dali incident at Baltimore. We've had strikes. We've had clampdowns on small package imports coming in via airports. I know we've got a lot of disruptions around. But generally, what does all this chaos mean for logistics networks in the US economy? Is it shop boardrooms? Has it brought politicians into the frame? Are they mulling a lot of this? Are they going to be debating about the election? Or maybe nothing's happened at all?
So I would say that I think that the net impact has actually been substantially less than many feared. We recently had received Census Bureau data that goes out from a survey for thousands of manufacturing plants that asked them, if you didn't operate at your what we call full production capability, what are primary reasons for that? And two of those reasons are logistics and transportation constraints. And then another reason is insufficient supply of materials. If you look back in 2021 and 2022, you see that those series just surge upward. We actually saw a decline in the first quarter of this year. And I think that is a combination of one, you know, demand is in general fairly weak for domestic manufacturing, which is meaning that any type of disruptions are being a little bit less felt. I think it's also the fact that most inputs are sourced locally or domestically, we could say in the U.S. But I think in general, you know, as just mentioned, we're getting very good at dealing with disruptions. Even with the Panama Canal water level issues, we didn't see any type of substantial drop in East Coast imports that would suggest, even from a country like China, which would be indicative that it was actually affecting import volumes. So I think that in general, the disruptive impact has been less pronounced. And I think the key reason, too, to think about the Red Sea crisis is it's a different type of shock than what we had post-COVID. In the post-COVID, it was 20% more containers moving or 10% more containers moving. Today, it's a few percent more containers moving than this time last year, but they're just going longer. And that has a big effect on the pricing on the ocean side, but it doesn't affect the domestic inland piece. And so that's why we're not seeing the congestion issues in the U.S. like we saw in 21.
There seems to be quite a lot of contradictory indicators out there. There was the ISM PMI for May was in contraction, but then the S&P Global U.S. Manufacturing May PMI was being revised up to 51.3 for May. We've had economists predicting a U.S. recession for the best part of 2 years, and some of them are still doing so, but we haven't really seen it too badly. The economy seems to has pushed on. It's not been thriving, but it's been okay. What's your view on a general sense in terms of economic growth and this dark cloud called inflation?
So I look and say inflation is largely under control in the U.S. When you really get down to it, a lot of our sticky inflation is due to housing pricing. And we have a special way of calculating housing, essentially housing pricing that the Europeans do not use. And when you use the European approach for measuring U.S. inflation, we're right at 2%. So I'm not too worried about consumer inflation at this point due to those methodological pieces. Right now, we're not seeing the type of increase in initial unemployment claims that would indicate we're moving into a recession. The freight economy has certainly been in the doldrums for almost, I'd say, about 21-ish months at this point in time. But it just doesn't look like it feels like we're moving along the bottom of a trough at the moment, but no real sign that we're going to fall down, but also no real sign, especially in a contentious election year where the Fed has not been able to cut interest rates like we originally anticipated, of that kind of oomph that we need from a demand standpoint to get us out of the trough. So to me, it's kind of, I think we're at the bottom and we're just scraping along it right now, maybe starting to trend up a little bit, but nothing that I get excited about yet.
Just on those containerized imports, Hackett Associates forecast that May volumes were over 2 million TEU, which would be the highest level since August 2022. Those monthly volumes are predicted to stay at over 2 million TEUs through September at least, so that's deep into the ocean shipping peak season. Volumes are up 15% in the first 6 months, so not insubstantial. J- Jess, what's going on? Is retail markets are firing? Is that it? Is this restocking? Is it something else?
Retail has continued to be strong. You know, shoppers going to shop. I think they're continuing to buy. And overall, retail is continuing to have a really healthy 2024. Retail growth is in that 3% range. Online sales are growing even at a better rate. So we expect that to continue for a strong finish through the holidays as well. And, you know, from an inventory perspective, I'd say the industry is mostly kind of returned to something closer to equilibrium from what we saw of the kind of big inventory swings of the last couple of years. And those import numbers are feeding a lot of those sales numbers, so replenishing shelves. But I think it's also a bit of moving up some timelines in order to avoid potential delays later on, whether that's from the labor negotiations on the Eastern Gulf Coast or uncertainty there, or if it's, you know, trouble getting access to capacity given the high freight rates and kind of challenges with the contract capacity rates, other disruptions. I think you see a lot of folks moving that forward. So whereas we might have seen peak in past times had been really a peak in that kind of August, September timeframe, I think it's a bit more of a kind of a mesa, if you will, a bit of a plateau that we'll see for longer as people kind of move some of that up for various reasons.
So you think we're in the peak season now, it's all come early this year, everyone's been shipping to avoid these potential disruptions later on in the year?
Yeah, I don't know about everybody, but we definitely, you know, have talked to folks who are moving things up. And I think from in terms of looking at volumes from the two coasts and that sort of thing, it's kind of split evenly as far as where people have shifted volumes back to the West Coast or to the West Coast versus the East Coast, or kind of waiting to see and not moving things up, or the folks who are just moving things up and kind of keeping them on the East Coast. So a bit split evenly, but I think we'll definitely continue to see strong import levels for the next handful of months. I think there is concern about the high spot rates and how that's challenging contract shipping from that standpoint, as well as some of the congestion and even equipment dislocation that we've been seeing, kind of these baseline murmurs of a bit of disruption and congestion, but not to the point of being terribly disruptive. I think there's, you know, a real sense of wanting to avoid potential delays and making sure that merchandise is there for the store sets and there for folks to buy it when they want to buy it.
Obviously, there's a lot of vessel delays over in Asia. There's equipment shortages. Some of those vessel delays are like 6 or 7 days. Are you worried that the cumulative effect of all of this might make those supply chains even more stretched, Jess, later in the year? Or will there be a subsidence of demand help people cope with this?
Yeah, not too worried, I think, at this point. I think, again, you know, we've built in a lot of time into these schedules, so as well as kind of a lot more ability to be nimble with some of these things. And I think people have planned to avoid potential for delays and have even been able to factor into an extent the delays that you're seeing kind of at origin. It's not really at a level at this point, and I don't expect it to get to kind of a significant level that it will tremendously affect supply chains. So not really concerned at this point, is I think everybody's really watching those leading indicators and making quick plans to or putting in place contingency plans to avoid any significant disruptions to that. And I think we'll see I don't want to say uneventful because that would be jinxing it, but I think, you know, everything is relatively smoothly set for the next handful of months.
A lot of positivity there. I'm going to put some numbers on those freight rates for people listening. Ocean rates into the US East and West Coast from Asia, they are pushing towards pandemic spread levels. So right now we're looking at over $6,000 per FEU on the Asia to US West Coast trade on the spot market, compared to less than $1,500 pre-Christmas. That's according to Freightos. Rates to the US East Coast are now around $7,500 per FEU into the East Coast. Carriers have introduced various surcharges, more are planned for the summer period. Most of this US trade, in theory, is moving under long-term contract, but we all know that doesn't always materialize when the spread between spot and contract rates gets rather tempting for carriers. And in that sort of market, SMEs tend to suffer the most, not the big shippers. How do you view this, Jason? Are you concerned, or is it not having such a big impact? Because the Trans-Pacific does have a high proportion of freight is contracted long term.
Yeah, so we're seeing that right now. If you look at container trade statistics data for Transpac West Coast, and that is what are the carriers actually receiving, contract and spot aggregated together, that's up only about 13% right now, actually above where it was in January of 2020. So it's not that much. That series, for perspective, had tripled at the height of the sort of pandemic surge in late 21, early 22, whereas spot rates are up 300% from that point in time. And so I think that you're seeing certainly the spot rate side, things have went up, but we're not seeing that showing up yet, certainly as this huge increases in what the carriers themselves are receiving. I think building on Jess's comment, a lot, some of this is certainly front loading right now because of concerns of disruption. And I think the other thing, too, it's important to remember the first half of 2023 was a horrible half in terms of containerized imports, because we were seeing very cautious ordering as retailers and wholesalers were trying to draw down inventory. And what that's doing is it's making the year-over-year comps seem probably more impressive than they are, because if you do a two-year stack, we're still down like 10% from where we were in 2022. And I think that that's the other reason when folks are looking for why are we not having disruptions on the inland side if imports are up so much year over year. It's, well, so we processed a heck of a lot more in the first half of 2022 than we did in the first half of 24. And so we have the ability to handle that. You know, I'm not worried right now too much from this isn't going to be inflationary or anything like that for the U.S. consumer. In reality, a very small percentage of what is consumed in the United States comes in containers. And so I'm not really concerned. And I hate to say it, but Walmart and Target ain't paying 300% higher spot rates. Does not work that way, or Home Depot.
No, they won't be, that's for sure. Just unpacking this demand side analysis a little bit more, Jason. You've been very careful in your analysis about talking about how we should think about the idea of restocking. In fact, I'll quote you, there is no such thing as restocking on the other side of a large inventory drawdown, where restocking would mean a disproportionate increase in physical inventories relative to sales. Are we seeing this type of restocking now, Jason? I'm going to call it just in case supply chain strategy, as that's the term that other people are using. But I know you're not a big fan of that phrase. Or is this all down to surprising consumer demand for imports?
So frame it a couple ways. So one, just in case inventory does not exist. I teach inventory theory. I teach a 4-hour exec ed seminar on inventory management. There is no such term as that. That was created by journalists who aren't inventory theorists. You're just...
It is interesting, though.
Oh, it is.
I'm defending my profession.
I know, but you're just changing the level of safety stock to deal with longer average lead times, more uncertain lead times, and more volatile demand. You naturally should see an increase in safety stocks in that setting. And so that's nothing special. That's not a difference in inventory policy. Most retailers order under a periodic review policy where they check inventory every week or every other week, and they place an order to bring them up to a maximum level. That's an inventory control policy right there. So setting aside the safety stock piece, this restocking idea, I don't know, again, where we dreamt up this concept, because it does not exist in economic theory about inventory or in any type of supply chain work. And I think what it is a misunderstanding of what happened in 2020 and 2021, where, take building material retailers like Home Depot. It's May of 2020, and people can't spend money anywhere else other than basically Home Depot. And they're like, hey, I want to put a new deck in because I'm stuck at home. So Home Depot, Lowe's, they see tremendous surges of demand. Their demand's up 15% on a unit basis where it was the prior year. No one is expecting this. And so their inventories get depleted. And this demand stays really high. And so they start ordering even more, because they not only need to bring inventory back to its prior level, but they need to actually increase the total amount of stock they have to keep it balanced relative to sales. We try to have essentially target inventory sales ratios, target days of supply or days to turn inventory, et cetera. Then in 2021, we have another demand shock with two stimulus efforts. And so all of this takes place and happens. Inventories again get drawn down. And so everybody then goes hog wild in 2021 ordering, because they think the super high demand is going to stay and their inventory is lower than they want it, and they overorder. Then we get a glut. So now our inventories relative to demand are way too high. So we have to start ordering even less than what our sales are to draw those inventories down. We're now getting, in most sectors, towards equilibrium. I'd argue building material retailers actually still have too much inventory relative to sales. that the idea now of restocking occurring where somebody says, okay, we're now back towards sort of our long-term target. Let's just add more inventory. No one's doing that. No one is going to do that. And so you now have an environment for, let's say, building material retailers where demand is down from 2021 and early 22 levels. There is no doubt of that. They're now back towards target inventories to sales. They're going to basically order based on their forecast to essentially replenish where demand is now. That's not going to lead to a surge of freight. And so that's why we have to abandon this restocking idea, because I've seen too many logistics providers saying publicly since 2023, the first part of the year, well, once inventories are balanced, then there's going to be restocking. And that has not materialized for a year. So, you know, boy who cries wolf, you can keep saying restocking, but it's not happened for a year.
We'll just take a short break. We'll be back with you in a second.
This podcast is proudly produced in partnership with Demerco Express Group, a trusted provider of global shipping and contract logistics services in Asia, Europe, and North America. Demerco's particular strength is in Asia, where it gives shippers the freight capacity and local market expertise to streamline freight movements to and from the region, particularly for trans-Pacific lanes. With 130 forwarding and logistics locations across China, India, and Southeast Asia, Demerco connects Asia with the world like no other global 3PL. You are listening to the Freight Buyers Club.
I'd love to know the origins of Just In Case, because I was just thinking about that. And any journalists or anyone else who's listening, please get in touch with me and let me know. I think the first time I heard it was, I won't name the company, but I was interviewing them and they used it during the interview. It was a big, huge supply chain analyst firm, I'll put it like that. That's the first time I remember hearing it, but maybe it was created by us hacks, who knows?
And it could have been created by one of those companies, but let's put it this way. Again, this is the challenge when we create these terms, because there is actually no such thing as a just-in-time inventory management control policy. You can look at any inventory textbook. That doesn't exist. And so the challenge is we use these terms, which aren't actually at the end of the day how an inventory planner goes into the system at Target and says, I need to place an order for X amount of product.
I'm going to banish the use of just in case to the dustbin of supply chain history here.
Thank you.
Now.
Thank We're you. Use, please. Thank
from
you.
From now on, it's Jason's terminology only.
No, yes. No, it's what Silver Pike and Peterson have talked about. And when Witten back in 1954, like we've been doing formal inventory control for 70 plus years. And so we have, there's really primarily about three or four control policies that's used, and none of them say just in time or just in case, and I won't bore people with what they're actually called.
Okay, Jess, all right, I'm gonna rephrase everything now. Are retailers building up safety stocks?
You know, I think that, you know, Jason makes a great point that the idea of just in time and just in case, I think these make, you know, for headlines and press, make nice, tidy counterpoints. But the reality is not that I think clear cut necessarily. I think, you know, there are kind of longstanding inventory policies and strategies. So it's not an idea of kind of off the cuff looking at shelving in the distribution center and thinking, well, we need to, you know, fill all this more up. We need more of this. It's all, you know, very, rigorous process, and has only become, I think, more so and more kind of intelligent with increasing addition of more technology and software, and using AI and machine learning to get hopefully smarter about these forecasting and inventory strategy decisions. So it's not quite as emotional as this idea of just in case and needing to restock because of concerns about potential out of stocks and that sort of thing. And I think, you know, to look at the metrics and the KPIs that, you know, our members, the large retailers, looking at the inventory sales levels and the turns and that sort of thing, these are the things that they're using to make decisions on. And I don't think that there is, it's not something you can classify as necessarily just in time. I think the public hears, you know, just in time is this impression of everything kind of humming along and things arriving just as they're needed and, you know, no kind of lag or dead time in the system and a very, very lean operation. But in reality, there is always safety stock. And I don't think there's a kind of grand movement to rebuild a lot of safety stock. I think the strategies that retailers set are kind of based on a lot of different factors to that. And it's not quite so emotional as perhaps headlines might make folks think. But I think we did see that period of, you know, that glut of inventory that retailers were carrying and honestly having, you know, hard times finding the shelving to even keep it and store it in DCs. But I think we have, like I said earlier, I think returned to something close to what you call equilibrium on the inventory front and aren't in quite the same breathless state that we had been in the past.
My headline making mind is ticking overtime here. I'm like, can I get away with calling this podcast the death of just in case logistics? Okay, let's have a look at domestic markets before we turn to some of the big hurdles that might be facing shippers later this year. Jason, we've discussed previously that we've had this domestic freight market recession in the US, as people have been calling it. Looking at some of the latest trucking data, it seems we're seeing that market pick up in the last month or so with DAT's dry van spot rate across the top 50 lanes in the US tracking 2023 rates, but miles off 2022 and 2021. Good news for freight buyers, of course. Will we see this dial move at all in sync with shipping import rates as those equipment networks into ports are stretched? Or is all this really down to primarily domestic industrial movements and normal seasonality?
Yeah, so I look at it this way. So June has always been, for DAT's data, typically a nice rise. And to put it in perspective, 2017, it was like 10 to 11 cents per mile higher than May. 2018, it was 18 cents higher than May. 2019, a down year, it was 10 cents higher in June than May. And so far, we are 3 cents higher this year in 2024. So this, even though it's up, this is actually weak on a seasonal basis. At the end of the day, containerized imports are a small percent of what gets moved. And an easy way to think about this is in 2023, Pierce tells us we imported 24 million TEUs in the United States. That's TEUs. Let's say 2 TEUs equals 1 truckload of freight. That's even being generous, but that gets us to 12 million. Now assume, and Jess can maybe confirm this, roughly about a third of containerized imports really don't leave the broader metro area in which they come. I mean, if it comes into Southern California through LA or Long Beach, about a third of that stays in Southern California because a lot of people live in Southern California. And conveniently, our ports are in major metro areas that are major sources of consumer demand. So that gives us 8 million truckloads of freight to move inland. Well, the class ones gobble up at least half of that on a mileage basis, at least half of that on intermodal. That gives us about 4 million truckloads of long-haul inland containerized imports. Domestic manufacturers generate 100 million truckloads a year of containerized imports, just for 100 million truckloads a year of freight, not of containerized imports, but domestic manufacturers make 100 million truckloads of freight. 4 million, 100 million. We can have 10% higher here. That gives us 400,000 extra. I can shave 1% off of this and I lose a million. And that's what we're experiencing right now. Historically, what has happened is containerized imports tend to trend strongly up year over year at the same time manufacturing output is trending up year over year. We've kind of broken that pattern so far in 24. We also broke that in 2015, believe it or not. And 2015 was a soft freight market. And so the two historical times where we've seen domestic manufacturing down year over year, but imports up, we've had bearish markets. And so for me, it's all about domestic manufacturing. And there's nothing really encouraging right now out there. You know, the one sector that's doing a little better is plastic production, which generates a lot of freight. But I'll tell you, I do increasingly have some concerns that I don't know how much longer we can stay at record levels in motor vehicle and parts production, just given where consumers are at. And so there could be offsetting forces there. But it's hard to get excited right now when I see primary metal production, steel and aluminum and things like that, today is down 7% from 2017. And 2017 was down 8% from 2014. And so in sector after sector in manufacturing, you can see output today is below where it was before COVID, in sectors like machinery below where it was in 2012 and 2014. So I'm just not encouraged from a demand standpoint right now that we're going to see that type of positive shock that we need to get us out of this current sort of trough that we're in.
Jess, feel free to come back on some of Jason's points, but I want to throw a few other recent news events at you that affect domestic or international movement. We've had threats of strikes from Canadian railroads that handle a lot of US imports, and this has prompted some vessel diversions. It's rumbling along without resolution as we're talking now at the end of the third week of June. This was alongside a threat of a Canadian customs strike, which was averted. We've also had a clampdown on air freight imports from China by US Customs and Border Protection. That's mostly aimed at Chinese exporters, but I'm guessing your members might have been on the end of some friendly fire as well. There's all more challenges for retailers, is it?
Yeah, I mean, to go back to the kind of the domestic truck market, you know, that's a concern for retailers as well, and the movement that they're doing domestically. I think the concern around just the financial health of the market, it doesn't serve anybody well for carriers to be going out of business or declaring bankruptcy. So I think it's important that the contract rates that they're looking at want to get something that's beneficial for both and that allows everybody to survive and provide some sort of, you know, equilibrium and health in the market. But I think that hopefully we'll see a bit of improvement, but it's, you know, concerning to see it kind of rumbling along that rock bottom for quite so long from that standpoint. And I think to your point around the Canadian rail situation, you know, obviously we're watching that pretty closely. You know, not only do many large retailers have suppliers in Canada or operations in Canada and stores, it doesn't take long for any sort of work stoppage or strike on Canadian rail to back up into the U.S. and start adding congestion to U.S. networks and ripple effects there. So concerns about that, you know, we don't expect anything to move on that before probably mid-July, but certainly something that we're watching. And it's really just the latest in kind of a long string of many labor topics that we've been talking about, whether it's the ports on the East Coast and Gulf Coast now, the West Coast before that, we've seen UPS, the U.S. rails. It's been a kind of a deja vu all over again with a lot of these labor situations, but certainly something we're watching from the Canadian standpoint, and our members are watching, you know, closely as well. With regard to the, you know, the customs and border protection, I think the whole de minimis conversation has really been in the news quite a lot. I'm pretty sure most consumers had never even heard the term until maybe a year or two ago, but we hear quite a bit about it now in kind of the evening news and the papers. From a realist standpoint, we're definitely watching CBP's enforcement efforts. It's important for all importers to be held to the same standards and complying with customs laws. So to ensure that those who are playing by the rules aren't being undermined. So it's certainly something that we're watching closely.
Looking forward, when we spoke a year ago, Jess, retailers were worried about US West Coast dock worker strikes. That was resolved. But now we have a standoff with the ILA union, which represents tens of thousands of dock workers at US East Coast and Gulf Coast ports. They are threatening strikes. Talks have broken down. How worried are retailers? Are they thinking of rerouting imports or exports? Maybe they did so already.
Yeah, like I said earlier, we've seen it split about evenly. We do pulse polls with members on a pretty regular basis to see how sentiment is kind of moving on this. Again, just more deja vu. We went through this with the West Coast not that long ago. And the East and Gulf Coast, you know, negotiations have historically been the kind of more less eventful, shall we say, of the two coasts. But this year, the East Coast certainly does seem to be trying to change that reputation a bit. The bottom line is that the parties need to get back to the table and resolve this contract as soon as possible, and hopefully well in advance of the September 30th expiration. As I said, we've talked to folks and it's kind of split evenly in terms of there have been volumes diverted to the West Coast to avoid any potential issues upcoming on the East Coast. Not as many as you might think, or not as many as maybe headlines or might have been threatening, but definitely some growth there, and you know, not enough to cause dramatic congestion on the West Coast ports and in Southern California. The others are moving those timelines up, like we talked about earlier, hearing definitely that it's happening to avoid even the potential for delays, just given the level of uncertainty, which, you know, as we like to say, uncertainty is kind of poison for supply chains. The other piece to that that we see is those who are in kind of a wait and see mode, given the timing and a bit more lead time to kind of play with a little bit. But who knows, perhaps the ILA walking away from negotiations the day before they were slated to start last week has maybe changed their wait and see mode and has given them reason to kind of take a little bit more action. But hopefully we can get this wrapped up with a minimum of disruption and not have to deal with yet another kind of 11th hour situation with a breathless last minute resolution.
What odds are a Biden administration intervention to resolve this dispute just ahead of the elections?
I mean, definitely the administration is watching this. Certainly the timing is not enviable for the Biden administration. the ILA knows this, and Daggett has said repeatedly that the intervention is not necessary and not really even welcome. There's a lot of rhetoric in the kind of approach to the negotiations as well. But I wouldn't be surprised to see intervention, but hopefully we can get it wrapped up more in line with how we've seen previous negotiations go on the East and Gulf Coast without having things quite so uncertain to the last minute.
Jason, the 2024 hurricane season is expected to be more active than normal, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. The worst hurricanes normally hit the Gulf and East Coast in August and September, which would be right in the middle of the peak shipping season. And also when we might see union disruption starting to peak, if that happens. How do hurricanes usually impact domestic freight markets? Or is this just one of those stories us journalists like to look at because it makes a nice headline?
Much more of the latter, to be honest. Former doctoral student who I worked with at the University of Arkansas, Travis Culpa, one of his dissertation essays actually looks at spot market responses to hurricanes using the most advanced approaches in economics for identifying causality. And of recent hurricanes, other than Harvey, which was a little bit of a bump, the bumps are incredibly minor. And at the end of the day, there's only one hurricane in the last 30 years that significantly positively affected freight demand, and that was Katrina. And you can see that in the surge of demand for construction supplies that we saw in the U.S. and that disaster's aftermath. Hurricanes get far overblown. The effects are so much more localized when we think about this relative to the whole freight market. So even, Harvey hit in the middle where we're already going up in a bull market. So that didn't really change anything from a freight demand standpoint. So short of something like a Katrina, which we, of course, hope never happens again, hurricanes are not going to move the needle in a substantial, sustained way.
Finally, Jess, pretty much everything around the cost of freight right now is built on Suez Canal diversions for container ships, which is having these big knock-on effects, even on air freight markets, as we've been talking about today. Supply demand would be entirely out of sync without this continuing, meaning there'd be a huge excess of containers and vessels. From a shipper's point of view, I'm sure your members would like a return to a buyer's market, but are your members drawing any lessons from how carriers are conducting themselves at the moment?
Yeah, I think all these market shifts that we've seen and all of the kind of upheavals of the past couple of years, for our members at least, have really underscored the importance of collaborative relationships and a more holistic approach to managing supply chains and working with your carrier partners. I think, prices definitely matter, the costs definitely matter, but it's not the only thing. And I think savvy shippers are aware and appreciative of that. I think when we talk to our members, they're looking to work with logistics providers that can be more of long-term partners and have the kind of staying power versus just kind of being a transactional kind of one-off in terms of shipping in most cases. Uncertainty is really the only certainty these days. So I think large BCOs are really looking for a reliable, building a reliable ecosystem of partners that they can work with and who will work with them to build that more responsive and kind of nimble nimble supply chain for that resiliency to respond to those sorts of things. The financial health of, the carriers is important, the service levels, and just the commitment to the opportunity for working together and instead of being more focused on chasing the dollar and more of kind of negotiation standpoint, really being a more collaborative long-term partner is much more important while still, keeping in mind that it's important for everybody to stay financially afloat.
In the previous episode of the Freight Buyers Club, we had an exclusive interview with Federal Maritime Commission Chairman Daniel Maffey. We covered everything from detention and demurrage regulations, a whole bunch of new initiatives out from the FMC that are designed to protect US shippers. Do your members, Jess, want him to do anything else that he's not already doing?
Well, the Federal Maritime Commission of the last recent few years compared to previously has been much more active in this space and taken several measures to exercise greater oversight with the ocean shipping industry and even in terms of, the enforcement aspect of things and auditing. The passage of the Ocean Shipping Reform Act last year gave them a lot more motivation as well as resources and capabilities to be even more active in this space. So it's satisfying to see progress being made, and they've been certainly very busy considering, they're not a large agency and they've been very active in terms of all the work that's come out of OSRA So it's been satisfying to see that progress, but it's also, you know, it's important not to take steps backward as well. You know, with you see the current petition that is, you know, they're accepting comments on about delaying the enforcement of the detention and demurrage rule. We don't want to take steps backwards with the progress that's been made. And I think the most important thing, and I think the FMC, you know, really tries to keep an eye on this is ensuring that there is a level playing field and that the ocean shipping market is one of robust competition in that space.
Jessica Dankert, Vice President for Supply Chain at the Retail Industry Leaders Association, and Jason Miller, Eli Broad, Professor in Supply Chain Management at Michigan State University. Thanks for joining me today on the Freight Buyers Club.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks for having us.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Freight Buyers Club, produced in partnership with the Demerco Express Group. Please subscribe and follow on your platform of choice or sign up for delivery to your inbox at thefreightbuyersclub.com. This podcast wouldn't have been possible without the fantastic editing of Karen Ball and Tom Matthews. And finally, thank you all for listening. The next episode will be with you soon.